It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How much do you think the American federal government spends on foreign aid? In a lot of surveys, Americans guess way too high. Our next guest says it's not our fault. Our country's leaders could do a better job communicating about these things. Aid has been in the national news as further financial support for Israel and Ukraine has been battled about and stalled in Congress. It's been linked to Republican concerns about the southern U.S. border with Mexico and a spending deal to keep the government open. We're going to talk now about foreign aid in general and then look at how spending on Ukraine could fit into the future of that country's strategy in the war fending off Russia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about American foreign aid? What are your perceptions of it? How much do you think the U.S. should spend on foreign aid? Do you think we get something out of what we put out there into the world? Is there a kind of foreign aid you think we should focus on more than others? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the book Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. He's also professor emeritus of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a newsletter piece you wrote in The Atlantic a couple months back. Tom, we see in the news a lot that, asking people questions in a diner, and you saw one answer about foreign policy that you've seen a lot. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw there when it came to foreign aid?
The biggest problem is that people come to that question with everything they know about it basically being wrong. They think that it's foreign aid is this gigantic part of the U.S. budget. They think it is sent overseas in, you know, big suitcases full of cash. And it's simply not true. And so, you know, part of the problem is that when you ask folks in a diner, what do you think we ought to do about foreign aid? The conversation is already off the rails because a lot of the premise of the question is already wrong. And so I think that's part of when I wrote the piece, and, you know, I have nothing against diners. My family ran one once. I think nonetheless that, you know, instead of asking people to expand on things that they're already mistaken about, the rest of us, including people in the government and scholars and others, should be clearer about communicating what's actually going on with things like foreign aid.
Can you talk a little bit about where foreign aid fits into our federal budget? Approximately how big a slice is it and what kind of things is it going toward?
Well, I always like to start by pointing out what people think it is. And the average American thinks that our foreign aid budget is anywhere between 15 and 25% of the U.S. budget. In some surveys, you'll get people thinking that it's 40 or 50% of the budget. It is 1% of the U.S. federal budget. In the big budgetary scheme of things, it's actually tiny. It's sometimes less than 1%, depending on the year. Now, 1% of a big number is nonetheless a big number. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when people say, look at all the billions of dollars going to foreign aid, well, yes, but in a multi-trillion dollar economy, that's still a pretty small percentage. And it's actually money that we mostly is used to buy products made by Americans and employ Americans to buy American stuff to send overseas, which I think a lot of people don't realize as well.
Can you talk about the kind of things this money is going toward? And let's start. We're going to spend more time on military aid in just a bit. Non-military, at least not directly military funding. What kind of things is that portion of that 1% of the budget going toward?
Well, it depends on the country and it depends on the recipient of the aid. And some of it is, just to be fair to the people who, you know, worry about sending cash. I mean, sometimes it is cash or loans or credits so that countries we're trying to help can buy things they need that we may not be able to provide them, that may be come from other, there may be services that they need to provide or people they need to hire. But when it comes to non-military aid, you could be talking about anything from food to clothing, to industrial equipment, things that make other things, vehicles, I mean, there's basically foreign aid could be almost anything that you could imagine it to be that you can spend money on. And again, I think that's an important understanding for folks who think that when they hear the word foreign aid, they just think of like a big, you know, container ship full of cash, which is not usually the way it's done. So it can be a lot of things from, you know, again, from food to clothing, to industrial equipment, to electronics. I mean, you name it. There's almost anything that could go into that.
An argument against that might be, okay, yes, this may be going toward a good purpose and helping people in the world, but in a situation of budget limitations, that money could be better spent here in the United States fixing insert long list of problems here. How do you make that case that given competing budget priorities, that money like this non-military foreign aid is money well spent?
Well, the first thing I'd say about competing budgetary priorities is that if you're really looking for things to cut in the budget that you think are choking the oxygen out of other things in the budget, foreign aid is like looking in the couch cushions for that extra change. I mean, that's to me, that's just it's a hot button issue because it's sent overseas, and it makes it easy to kind of demonize that. But a couple of other things I'd say about it is, first, you know, we're a superpower. We have a foreign policy, and that foreign policy includes relations with other parts of the world where that aid makes those places more stable and makes us safer. And I think people forget that as well, that foreign aid isn't just a gift. It's not something we do. You know, sometimes we do it out of a charitable purpose, but mostly it's done because it's good for us in the United States to have other parts of the world be stable and friendly to the United States. People, I think, sometimes forget that part of keeping the American standard of living high is to make sure that the United States has free access to the oceans, to the skies, that we have a dominant voice in things like trade and how it's conducted around the world. The world basically runs on the Washington rules. And I think people sometimes forget that it could be very different and their standard of living could be impacted very heavily if the world were run on Beijing rules or Moscow rules. And it would be a very different world. And so foreign aid is, I would argue, foreign aid is a tiny investment that produces an immense return in terms of our relations with the rest of the world. And I'll just make one other comment, which is people do this with everything in the budget. They say, well, we're totally strapped for money. How can we spend any money, you know, on this part of the budget when we're not spending it on that part of the budget? And I'm just going to point out that this is a country that spends billions upon billions of dollars a year on snack foods and, you know, gambling and, you know, I have a cat food, animal care. We spend a lot of money on a lot of stuff. And I think sometimes there's a really, especially in Congress, when people start playing the game of what to fund, there's really some bad faith involved here, as though sending money to a foreign country, you know, that the only two choices are build schools or send money to a foreign country. And I think that's a false choice. And I think usually a lot of people who do that are acting in bad faith.
Talking to Tom Nichols about foreign aid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tom, turning to military aid, and let's set aside crisis situations, which are getting into like support for Ukraine or Israel now. Year to year, without those kind of extraordinary moments, what is the role of U.S. military foreign aid?
Well, it's the short version is to make our friends and allies safer and to provide them with the ability to defend themselves and to help the United States, not just within our alliances, but, you know, again, within a kind of global system of cooperation and trade and security, to help them make their part of the world safer. And I think one other part of that I think sometimes people forget about is that other nations are going to buy weapons. And the question is, would you rather that they buy those weapons and have those systems controlled by us or by other people. And when I say controlled, I mean trained, the ability to send spare parts, the ability to have influence on those countries. I mean, if you provide weapons to another country, you're part of the dialogue about their security. If you tell them that you're not going to help them with those weapons, not only are you not buying those in the United States, which puts American workers to work, you're basically saying, well, we're not going to talk to you about your security. Go talk to Moscow or Beijing or you know, or even our friends in Europe. You know, go get your weapons somewhere else. And I think that there are a lot of times that we shouldn't do that, that we want to be able to say, look, we will help you with your security, but that involves us in how you're using those weapons.
We're talking about foreign aid, what it is, what it costs, how we benefit from it with Tom Nichols, staff writer at The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Coming up, military aid to Ukraine, a new rounds of it held up in congressional funding debates. What do you think? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation. Maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Tom Nichols from The Atlantic, looking at foreign aid in general, and we'll get into specifically U.S. aid for Ukraine in the war to fend off the Russian invasion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I mean, aside with Ukraine, aside from the global threat to democracy, and if Russia wins, you know, the realignment of powers tilted towards China and Russia and Iran, if Russia does win and then invades a NATO country, the cost to us is going to be so much more financially and in terms of U.S. lives, because now we have to join this war. So I guess I don't understand why people, if they don't know that or they're not taking into account, or this is just an ideological thing, they don't care.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Tom, Lisa brings us now to U.S. support from Ukraine. In a sense, she says, a bargain.
It absolutely is a bargain. For about 10% of what we spend on national defense, the Russians at this point have destroyed something like 90% of the army they began with. Now, they've had to replenish that and redraft men and, you know, rebuild the weapons that they've lost. But the Russians have engaged in a war of imperial aggression. They're basically trying to genocide the Ukrainians out of existence. And the United States and its allies have inflicted an immense toll on Russia for this. As I said, 90% of their initial force that they began with, and about 2/3 of their armor. And so, you know, the idea that somehow this is money poorly spent, first of all, it's important to do it, whether it's cost effective or not. This is one of those cases where you just don't get to pick the fight that broke out. But the way that it's been progressing, that the amount of money that we've sent and the kind of military effect that it's had has really been remarkable. And your caller's absolutely right that if Russia manages to subjugate Ukraine, turn it into just another part of the Russian Federation, wipe out, you know, more people than they've already been killing, the money that we're spending now, we will wonder why we castigated ourselves about this tiny amount of money, relatively tiny amount of money, compared to the gigantic threat that we'd be facing down the line.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. About a month ago, we talked to Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson about what turned out to be a failed spending bill that would have included funding for both Israel and Ukraine in their respective wars. Still being debated whether that aid is going to happen in the latest spending. Here's a little of what Senator Johnson said about Ukraine.
The only way this war ends is through a negotiated settlement. Ukraine can't win this war. Russia won't lose it. They have nuclear weapons. Losing the war is existential to Putin. They can wait it out. Ukraine can't start bombing Moscow to reduce the support for the war in Russia. So this has to end in a negotiated settlement. And every day that goes by, more Ukrainians, civilians and soldiers die. More Russian conscripts die. I take no joy in that. More of Ukraine gets destroyed. So I don't think it's been a bad thing that Zelensky understands that he doesn't have an open checkbook for an endless war.
Tom, your thoughts on Senator Johnson's comments?
Well, unfortunately, Senator Johnson is emblematic of the completely unserious way that the Republicans are approaching this war. I mean, there are so many straw men in that argument that you could populate all of the cornfields of America with them. Among the largest and most important among them is people who talk about a negotiated settlement seem simply not to understand that Vladimir Putin is not interested in a negotiated settlement. He dangles things on occasion, but he has made it very clear that his goal and what he will only accept is the eradication of Ukraine as a state, as a place. And the people who speak for him, the people who are the Kremlin mouthpieces on Russian television, openly talk about genociding the Ukrainians out of existence. This is now a pure rage on the part of the Russian regime because of the Ukrainian unwillingness to submit in 3 or 4 days as the Russians expected them to. The other problem here, of course, is when people like Senator Johnson say, well, you know, Ukraine can't win this war. Every day that Ukraine survives is a day that they're winning and that the Russians are losing. And the Ukrainians have actually slowly and at great cost recaptured much of the territory they lost over the past 2 years. The Russians are bearing an immense strain, as the Ukrainians are, but the Russians are basically trying to just grind down a defensive position in Ukraine. And they have, again, they've lost 2/3 of the armor they went in with. So, you know, I think this is just an utterly unserious position. And it's not upon us to tell the Ukrainians to hand over pieces of their country. The Ukrainians have said that they want to fight, that they want to defend themselves. They are asking us for the weapons and the tools they need to defend themselves. That we can't tell them not to do that. And I think part of what's going on, and this is, I think, the most unfortunate part of it, is that in part the Republicans in Congress who oppose spending to Ukraine, because remember, most Republicans, about half now, the number has been dropping, but most Americans and even a plurality of Republicans are still in favor of helping Ukraine. But the elected Republicans who are opposing this are primarily doing this as a kind of way of kind of like an oppositional defiance disorder, where they're opposing it because it's something the Biden administration wants. And so it's become a political football. But there was once a time in American politics where this would have been a bipartisan no-brainer to help these people. And I think it still is. But unfortunately, again, the debate is dominated sometimes by these straw men and false assumptions that you just heard from Senator Johnson.
Let's go back to our callers. Chris is with us in Menominee. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I just heard that clip that you played of Mr. Johnson. And I just want to take direct aim at Senator Johnson, and I reside in District 3, and my local representative is Derek Van Orden. And I will be heading to the polls this November, and this will weigh directly. And I would like to just express how much this will weigh on the balance of my decision-making. Anybody who wishes to leverage diplomatic policy, our domestic policy, for what we're doing in our international policy, our foreign policy, is sorely mistaken, because this is a mistake. The rhetoric that they are using is a mistake, and what they're saying they know is untrue, and I adamantly disagree.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Not a lot of time left. Tom, do you think there are a lot of voters along Chris's line who will punish a politician for, as he says, tying their domestic priorities to what we do internationally?
I don't know. Americans traditionally don't put foreign policy very high on their list of things to vote about until it goes wrong, until something is a crisis, or that there's some really terrible sense of threat. But I do think I agree with your caller that I think it's irresponsible to do this. I mean, we used to say that foreign policy ends at the water's edge and that we always had a bipartisan foreign policy. That wasn't completely true. I mean, the parties did fight about foreign policy right through to the end of the Cold War. But there's a real irony here that the Republicans of all people are the ones now who are basically arguing for caving to the Russians and telling the Ukrainians to surrender. That's a real sea change in that party. And I think that there is a generation of people, and maybe I'm one of them since I grew up during the Cold War, who will vote based on the idea that, you know, whatever our other differences, you don't simply hand entire countries over to the Kremlin. I hope that's true. And I suspect it's primarily a generational issue, but it was once something that Americans could agree about. And I think your caller really reflected that.
Briefly, Tom, what are you watching for in Congress as they debate the latest spending bill? Do you think foreign aid will rise back to the top and end up being passed?
Well, foreign aid will rise back to the top if the dozen or so chaos agents in Congress decide to make it an issue again, because it really is a very cynical manipulation of the budget. I mean, you have somebody as conservative as the Speaker who worked out a deal with the Senate to get a budget done, and immediately he just got hammered by people who really don't want to have anything done. And I think it's foreign aid just becomes a football net. The people who just don't want there to be a budget, who don't care if there's a government shutdown, who don't care if the government functions day to day. There's about two dozen of these folks in Congress, and you know, foreign aid could well become an issue again if they think it's a convenient hammer to blow up the budget and blow up budgetary talks yet again.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked to him about U.S. foreign aid, how lawmakers can, and he says, should do a better job explaining it and where things go from here with U.S. support for Ukraine. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.